to Hey Siri, a podcast about psychology, relationships, and most importantly, piping hot tea. Sit down, take a sip, and remember to subscribe as resident pop culture expert Xochi and struggling PhD student Siri take you through the what, why, and how of relationship research and what that means for your non-scientifically researched relationships. All of this research is coming out all the time, but academic literature can be intimidating and difficult to connect to real life. So let us do it for you.
Siri will tell us all about what research is taking the psychology world by storm. On today's episode, she will tell us all about the phrase, opposites attract. Do they really? Why or why not?
After hearing the research for and against attracting your opposite, Xochi and Siri will discuss Phil and Claire's long and exciting relationship and discuss whether being so different from each other helps lengthen it or causes tension. Okay, so I feel like in a lot of cases when we talk about things, there's not a straightforward answer. In this one, there is. There's a very, very clear answer here.
We love that.
So, I mean, cutting right to the chase, and I know we've talked about this before. The article I found is from spring of this year, 2021, called Perceived Similarity in Personality Ideologies Predicts Relationship Satisfaction Across Sexual Orientation Spectrum. And this article had a lot of authors. So Virginia Wickline is going to get all the credit, but it was really Virginia Wickline et al. And it was published in the Association for University Regional Campuses of Ohio Journal. So the authors begin the article by addressing the importance of similarity for couple relationships and debunking the idea that opposites attract. Right off the bat.
Spoiler alert, God.
And there's a lot of theories that have been constructed to describe, you know, this idea that similarity is really important for couples. The thing that begins, you know, or the thing that's applicable to the beginning of the relationship is the similarity attraction effect, which is basically that, like, being similar to someone else will strengthen your initial attraction to them. Like, right off the bat. And then, more similar couples tend to stay together because during the selection process of initial dating, dissimilar couples are more likely to break up, and they actually become more similar across time. During the alignment process, which is basically this ongoing relationship stage, you know, they become more homogeneous. And there was another study that I really wanted to talk about that we have to get to later because it was just more specific, but basically, like, couples, as they're together for a long amount of time, they start to talk more like each other. And this study showed that by looking at their text messages of, like, committed couples, and found that their texting lingo became more similar the longer they were together.
That is, yeah, I think even with, like, relationships I've had with friends, after the longer we get to know each other, the more we talk like each other and the more we use each other's slang.
Yeah. And I mean, we know that that's an important part of having a stable relationship. You know, the Gottmans, one of their principles for making marriage work is letting your partner influence you. And part of that is, you know, when you do let your partner influence them and you agree with them, you are becoming more similar to them on certain things. So, yeah. Opposites generally do not attract. But, like, I mean, it's important. I feel like it's important to recognize that you don't have to be similar to your partner on everything. And, like, another, I don't know if it's the Gottmans or who would it, you know, it is the Gottmans as well. Everything's the Gottmans. They say that, like, you're gonna have things that you don't agree on, and that's okay, and it just has to be things that you are okay with disagreeing about. And the research from my lab has shown the same thing. One important way that couples can reconcile after they have conflict is to just agree to disagree. Like, explicitly say, like, that's fine, let's move on. And that, you know, helps with recovery after conflict and basically just, you know, coming back together. So one important individual characteristic that predicts relationship satisfaction is personality. And I want to ask, have you heard of the Big Five model of personality?
No.
No? Okay, this is what we use in psychology. It's called the five factor model or the big five model. And basically the primary personality traits are openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So like the big five personality traits. And these are on a continuum, right? So like, for example, with extroversion, there's high extroversion and low extroversion. And low extroversion would be like introversion. We don't like talk about it like that. And then like high agreeableness, low agreeableness. And low agreeableness would be like
Disagreeableness,
exactly. But like it's just on a spectrum of agreeableness.
Right.
And especially in couple relationships, agreeableness and neuroticism are like really important when it comes to relationships. So in couple relationships, both partners' personality traits have been shown to predict relationship satisfaction. So basically, your own personality traits can influence your own relationship satisfaction. And then your partner's personality traits can influence your satisfaction. So, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. Your partner is like really neurotic, you're gonna like be a little annoyed with them.
Yeah, and especially if you guys live together, I mean, being around stress makes you stressed.
Exactly. And the association between personality and relationship satisfaction has been shown in cross-sectional studies where they just look at couples like in one moment in time, but also in longitudinal studies where they assess changes in couples' relationship satisfaction over a period of months or years. So personality doesn't just affect your in-the-moment relationship satisfaction, it impacts changes in relationship satisfaction across years. It's very, very important. And other researchers have looked at similarity in couple partners' personality traits as they predict satisfaction. But the results of these studies are less consistent, so some have shown that similarity in personality traits is related to satisfaction, others don't really show a consistent pattern. So it's less clear. But another set of characteristics that are predictive of satisfaction are ideologies. So, you know, a person's values and goals, and especially the ones related to the romantic relationship. So previous research is more clear about the associations between ideologies and relationship satisfaction. And across the board, it looks like more similarity in relationship-related ideologies between couple partners is associated with higher satisfaction. And there was only really, like, one significant difference, and it was gender-related, where women's career focus was negatively related to satisfaction, but men's was positively related.
Wow.
And it's, like, this makes total sense to me that, like, you know, with the gender norms and roles and socialization that women get, like, I feel like women are not as encouraged to put their career first, but men are. And so, like, it's expected that a woman, and we've talked about this before, like, when a couple has a kid, it's kind of expected, and I've seen it a lot, that women are the ones who put their career aside to be a stay-at-home mom, and men aren't expected to do that. And so I definitely think that that could reflect in relationship satisfaction when women are taking control of their career and putting that first.
Right. When they're not just willing to give up, you know, the entire life that they've built.
Yeah.
Because they have a baby.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it's not even just when you have a kid. Like, I mean, it's for me as someone who's in this really intense stage of my career, it's like I can't imagine having a partner that didn't value that drive, because, you know, I don't want to, and I know this isn't like, I don't want this to be long term, but I've been working 14-hour days and I work on the weekends, and, you know, my husband just takes over and picks up the slack, and he looks after the pets and he cleans the house and he cooks, because, you know, I'm really focused on my career. And so for me, I don't think there's a negative relationship with my satisfaction with the relationship, but I can totally see for women whose partners are not willing to pick up the slack that it would definitely be negative.
Right.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah. So similarity on family values, political attitudes, like religion, family values, political attitudes, like desire to have children, like that kind of thing, have a stronger effect when it comes to similarity and relationship satisfaction than religion and spirituality. So people don't need to be it doesn't matter as much whether you're similar on religion, as long as you're similar on these other ideologies. And it's funny, we went over this in my intimate relationships class this semester, but actually that seems to be a product of your generation. So previous generations, it was more important than now. And then a final point before we do get into the study itself, there is a difference between actual and perceived similarity.
That makes sense.
And that actually may have affected some of the results in past studies that didn't consider this, because recent research indicated that perceiving your partner as similar to yourself is more important when it comes to predicting satisfaction and attraction than how similar you and your partner actually are.
That makes a lot of sense, though, because I feel like some things would maybe fall to the wayside and when we're looking mainly at, like, goals and relationship ideals and stuff like that. Like, what is your favorite genre of movie? Can you go watch trashy movies with your partner every Friday at the trashy movie theater? That can be very important to some people.
It's more like, like, let's say your partner does go watch trashy movies with you every Friday. And you perceive that as them being similar to you and that they like watching trashy movies, when in actuality, they don't like them at all. They just do that because it makes you happy. So, like, you perceiving them as similar to you, even if they just do it for you, is more important than the fact that they don't actually like them that much.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of what that is talking about. So we have all this previous research. The primary purpose of the current study was to determine whether these findings held true for couples across the sexual orientation spectrum. We'll get into this. I have some thoughts about how they did this. But, you know, as we know, most research tends to focus either exclusively on heterosexual or homosexual individuals or couples. And all the research that they went over, apparently, was only done with heterosexual couples. And then previous research is really focused on ideologies related to families and children, rather than, like, life goals in general, and hasn't been able to draw consistent conclusions when it comes to the importance of religion. So another goal of the current study was to focus on the similarity of overall life goals and religion as it relates to couple satisfaction. The authors hypothesized that there would be a positive relationship between perceived similarity in personality and perceived similarity in ideologies and relationship satisfaction with a current or past partner. So notice that they said perceived. They actually asked participants, this wasn't a dyadic data collection. They just recruited participants and asked them, oh, how similar is your partner to you on this? So it's not actual similarity, it's whether the participants perceived their partners to be similar to them. So to test their hypotheses, they did a series of three studies. The first was just a pilot study. They recruited students and staff from university through Facebook and email. They ended up with 134 participants, 82% female, as usual, more females than males, 93% white, which was not great. But again, this is just a pilot.
That's very white.
And an average age of 34. 87% were heterosexual, and 86% were currently in a relationship. The rest of them answered the survey reflecting on a past relationship. And then almost half of those in a relationship were married, so large married portion. Participants were asked to complete an adapted version of an online assessment from loveisrespect.org, assessing relationship satisfaction. Loveisrespect.org, I've heard of them, and let me just make sure. Yeah, so it's basically this organization that fights against domestic violence. And so they'll ask you questions and you can, like, I'm guessing that assessment is looking at, like, you know, giving people a chance to actually look objectively at how happy they are in their relationship. It's a really good website, so.
We love that.
I just wanted to publicize that. And a personality assessment created by the authors, in which participants indicated their and their partner's levels on each of the big five personality traits. They also indicated whether they were similar to their partner on hobbies, career goals, desire for children, religion, political views, and financial matters. And then finally, they completed a series of demographics, and this entire survey was completed online, as they were in all three studies. And then participants were entered into a drawing for a $50 gift certificate following completion of the survey. So, the chance to get $50. The results indicated that perceived similarity in personality traits was associated with higher relationship satisfaction, as was perceived similarity on all of the ideology items. So the more similar you are, the more happy you are. And further analyses indicated that across all of the ideology domains, participants who were totally unmatched in similarity with their partners were less satisfied than those who were totally matched, meaning like, oh yeah, we agree completely. But there was no significant difference in relationship satisfaction between those who were somewhat and totally matched. So whether you were like, oh yeah, we have like about the same views, or like we have some different views, but overall, you know, we're kind of similar. And whether you, you know, were like, oh yeah, we're totally similar, like you'd have about the same amount of relationship satisfaction.
That makes sense to me. I mean, there's compromises in every relationship.
Yeah. Exactly.
A lot of them don't matter.
Yeah, no, that's so true. So in the second study, the authors recruited participants from Amazon's Mechanical Turk to see if the findings were replicated in a more diverse sample from across the U.S. I would argue about, well, no, they did kind of get a more diverse sample. They got 143 participants. This one was 63% male, which I was like, we've not seen that before.
Boys showing up.
Yeah. 76% white, so still majority, but less than the first one, with an average age of 34, so like literally same. 84% were heterosexual, so a little less than the previous. 84% were in a current romantic relationship, and they used the same measures as in study one, and participants were compensated $1.50 for participating, because the survey only took like 8 minutes, so they were like, okay. So, as with the first sample, perceived personality trait similarity was positively associated with the relationship satisfaction. So, the more similar you are in your personality across all of the five traits, the happier you were. But the results for the ideology items were a little bit different. So, in all cases except for hobbies, people who did not match had lower satisfaction than those who did and those who somewhat matched. For the hobbies, people who were totally unmatched were less satisfied than those who were totally matched, but there was no significant difference in satisfaction between unmatched and partially matched individuals, and also no difference in satisfaction between partially matched and totally matched. So that was weird. So for hobbies, if you were totally unmatched or you had some similarity in hobbies, you would have the same amount of relationship satisfaction, which is weird.
That's weird.
But you know what? Like, your hobbies, like, you can have separate... I mean, I think if I was, like, my husband has separate hobbies from me. Like, I don't play video games. I just don't like them. But, like, that's fine.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then the same was found for similarity on religion and financial matters. In regards to desire for children, people who weren't matched were less satisfied than those who were.
That makes a lot of sense.
But there was no significant difference in satisfaction between those who were partially and fully matched. That surprised me. Because, like, if your partner is, like, with children, right? If you're like, oh, I really want kids, and your partner's like, nah, maybe I want kids, that way could be considered partially matched. And apparently, that, like, a couple that was like that, their relationship satisfaction would be totally the same as a couple who are both like, yeah, I totally want kids, which I would not expect.
That is very strange to me.
Yeah. So that was interesting.
You'd think that there'd be at least somewhat of a difference.
Yeah.
Not even that either one is necessarily unsatisfied, just like...
Right, that there would be, like, a little bit of difference somewhere. So in their third study, and they attempted another replication with a more ethnically diverse university sample. So they recruited 179 undergraduates from a southeastern university. 64% were white, so we're dropping a little more there. 23% African American, 6% biracial, 5% Latinx, and 2% Asian. This was interesting reading this because I have been seeing and I have been told when I've been writing research proposals not to use the term Latinx.
I've also seen, I don't do what you do in the academia, but I've seen on the internet that that was a very sort of, I want to say white savior complex coming into play there, because it doesn't make any sense in the Spanish language. Mm-hmm. They said, if you really don't want to say Latino, I've seen people just say, you know, say Latin.
So, yeah. Well, okay, so what I was told, and I have two issues with this, because what I was told is to put Latino / a or Hispanic.
But Latin and Hispanic are two different things.
No, I know, but here, well, I mean, you can also do another thing, which we did, actually, we do it at school, too, we did it at my job, was to have Latin O / a, and then have a separate section that says Hispanic or no, and so I've always included the percentage that were, like, you would say, like, non-Hispanic white, Hispanic white, non-Hispanic, right. Latino, you know what I mean?
That makes sense, yeah.
Which I actually don't normally see, I realize, in research, which is weird to me. I see it sometimes. But yeah, I didn't. I was like, that's interesting.
What would you say you see the most right now?
Actually, Latino / a or Hispanic, probably the most common.
That's the one I see the most. I also, one of the first times I ever saw or heard of the term Latinx, the person introducing it to me pronounced it Latinx, and I was done. I was already done with that phrase. It wasn't for me, and I didn't like it.
Yeah. No, that.
And I feel like that has been since a little bit corroborated by people who are Latin.
Yeah. Anyway, not to criticize this, because it's already published. And 2% Asian. This group was 79% female with a mean age of 20, so, like, really young, which they did acknowledge was really young because it was university sample. 85% were heterosexual, and 40% were dating less than a year, with 34% dating 1 to 3 years. So, big difference in the marital status of these kids. All measures were identical to the studies used in 1 and 2, and participants received research credits for their participation.
So more valuable than either of the other ones.
Yeah, well, this is just, I mean, that's the thing, is, like, they did have, you know, about the same results across people who are majority married. So we're like, okay, well, among these people who are majority dating, like, are we going to see the same thing? And especially, almost 50% dating less than a year, so fairly short relationships. Mm-hmm. But even among this sample, perceived similarity in personality traits, who's listed with higher relationship satisfaction, they wrote, the way they wrote this was just a little confusing, because they did say at first that perceived similarity wasn't associated with relationship satisfaction for religion and politics items, and then later they said that again in the discussion. But then in the actual results, they said that all items except religion, that across all items except religion, people who matched were more satisfied than those who somewhat matched and did not match. So, like, I think they just forgot to put except religion and politics.
Whoops.
Yeah, that was the oopsie. It's okay. But yeah, so that aligns with all of the other studies. So, you know, if you're matched, you're going to be more satisfied, yeah, than those who somewhat matched and did not match. But also across the board, as we saw before, so for hobbies, career goals, desire for children, and financial matters, there was a significant difference in relationship satisfaction between those who matched and those who were somewhat matched and unmatched. But again, no difference between the somewhat matched and unmatched groups.
It sounds like these people haven't really been in these relationships long enough for them to be like, no, we've run into things that we realize we're compromising on. Maybe some of them, if they're 20, they haven't really in-depth discussed some of these things. Like children? career goals, they don't really know yet.
Yeah.
Financial matters, they're both poor, so.
That's true. That's true. Well, also, I mean, one thing that I noticed and I made a note to mention was that when I was looking at the number of people in each group, so the totally matched, partially matched, and unmatched, like, for hobbies, the unmatched group was 4 people. The matched group was 113 people.
Right.
And the somewhat matched group was 62. And then for Desire for Children, the unmatched group was 28 people, matched group was 133, and somewhat matched was 18. So from what I understand, you want to have at least 20 people in each group, which is why they did look at effect sizes, and effect sizes were moderate, but I still would be a little cautious, kind of relying on results with that few people in each group. Not that they're not interpretable, but just you want to be a little cautious there. But, I mean, overall, well, also I was very interested that they went into this wanting to find out whether previous research could be replicated across sexual orientations. Then they didn't divide the groups by sexual orientation to compare the effects. They just looked at them all.
Maybe because it was like 20%, they didn't want them to feel awkward.
The participants didn't have to do anything. This would be an analysis. And 20% is definitely enough to have a separate group. Even if your separate group, right, is just LGBTQ+.
Would T really be counted in there?
No, not T, sorry. LGB.
Gotcha.
Plus. Huh. So people who didn't want to specify but said they were queer, people who are bisexual, people who were gay.
Right.
You could have them in a group.
Right. They probably don't act, like, super duper different from each other, to be honest.
Yeah, and I don't think you'd find, I mean, well, see, that's the thing, is I saw one study a really long time ago that said that, like, for lesbian and gay couples, similarity didn't matter as much, just because you have a smaller pool, so you kind of have to, you can't be as choosy.
Yeah, make it work.
Yeah, so I was a little disappointed. Yeah, I would have really liked to see the difference if they compared them.
There is a pretty long-standing joke within the lesbian community, and I don't know if this is still a thing because it started as a joke when the women loving women community was still like super duper small and secret. but there, on a few shows like the L Word and, you know, just lesbian based content, there were jokes where lesbians don't understand why straight people have issues with their partners being friends with their exes or vice versa, because in the lesbian community, you've definitely dated each other's exes, and you probably met through them.
Yeah.
So, you're probably at their fondue party right now, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I would be interested in that. I would like to see that. Like, literally a comparison. Where, you know, you have categories, and one of the categories is straight, one of the categories is queer, or LGB+, you know. If you can't find a big enough sample of, I mean, ideally, right, it would be straight, bisexual, gay, or lesbian. I guess just queer, or maybe unidentified.
But God, there's so few of us, and we're all busy. We're so busy. That's why we're always walking places fast. You know, whenever you see gays walk, and they're, like, walking super fast, and you're like, where are you going?
Oh, my God. But that's okay. So, the moral of the story is, ideally, you would agree with your partner on major values and life goals, you know? But if you partially agree with them, that's also great. You're going to be happier. If you make some compromises, that's fine. But there should be some degree of similarity, because being totally dissimilar does seem to be related to relationship dissatisfaction. But according to the results of this study, if you're younger, well, okay, also hobbies don't seem to matter as much. You can have different hobbies. But if you're younger, it seems like similarity on religion and politics doesn't really seem to matter as much as other types of life goals and values. The politics was interesting to me, and I wonder if that's because of the location of the university in the southeast.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you had participants who were in the south or on either of the east or west coast, you would see a difference there where politics does matter. That's my suspicion.
Would you say the same thing for religion, maybe? Like,
I feel like maybe religion would matter in the south, but yeah, maybe not on the east or west coast.
Interesting. I think that makes sense.
For younger people. Because I see a lot of, like, I don't know, I see a lot in the Jewish community, and I'm sure that this happens in other communities, that, like, your parents don't want you to marry someone who's, like, not Jewish, but the younger kids don't care. They're like, oh, I'm going to marry who I want.
I think our parents are slightly, and grandparents are a little bit still dealing with some generational trauma at the moment. Yeah. The Holocaust was in the 40s, but they'll come around.
In other religions, too. I think there are other religions, like, I'm sure Catholics, I've heard this, right, that, like, Catholic moms and dads don't want their children to marry a non-Catholic.
Yeah, well, I don't understand what that's about. I totally get where a lot of Jewish parents are coming from, where they're like, our race isn't going to die out, is it? Like, is our culture going to die?
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, you can have different hobbies, but you gotta agree on most things.
I love it when people have different hobbies to me, because I don't have any hobbies. So I like stealing other people's.
I have a bookshelf full of books that, because I keep buying books, like, oh, I'm so excited to read this book.
Is reading a hobby?
Yes.
Oh.
It's definitely a hobby.
I guess I have a hobby. Boom.
Thank you.
Suck it.
We got you a hobby.
Thank God.
Okay.
Should I cut that part that I said that queer people walk super fast?
Maybe.
Is that homophobic?
Maybe, just so you don't offend anyone.
Bro, we're speed walking everywhere.
You're gonna get, like, listeners writing in, being really mad at us, and I'm gonna have to deal with it, and I didn't even say it.
Listeners, if you know a queer person who walks very fast, please write in. Adversely, if you don't know any queer people...
Ooh, do write in.
Or... If you do know queer people, but they're very slow walkers.
That's a double-barreled question. They should write in separately.
Very smell the flowers. Okay, there are three options. Okay.
We need an answer for all three.
Option one. Queers are fast. Option two. Queers are not fast. Option three.
Yes.
I don't know any queers.
Yes. That's how it should be.
Should I cut that entire part because I said queers?
You are responsible for checking our email, not me. I'm not dealing with this shit. I get enough emails criticizing me as a person from my supervisor.
Okay. I'm not going to cut anything. Editing is really hard. So the pop culture connect, I think, actually kind of supports what I'm about to say. Because I'm giving a lot of opinions in this one, because since it's focused on so many relationships, mostly familial relationships, there's some guesswork to be done here.
You know, I just rewatched Modern Family, like, from the top to the bottom.
Good. What did you think? Does it hold up?
It did hold up. It had the same problems that I originally saw, but overall it was still very sweet.
I think I was really surprised in doing research for this episode, because I was pretty young still when it came out. It came out in September 2009. I was, what, 12 or 13?
This is why you don't give someone with a learning disability a question on the spot. Let's see. You were 11.
I was 11.
And I was 13.
Are we sure? But I was born in 98.
Yes, I know.
Oh, I can't do math. So, I was 11, so I didn't realize, like, how, I guess, pioneering this was. I was also raised in a very progressive family
in California.
Fairly progressive part of town, if you refer to, you know, if you consider Los Angeles progressive, sure. But this show had the first same-sex kiss on primetime television.
Oh, I did forget about that. See, that's crazy to me, because now, like, you know, you watch any show and there's, I mean, I don't want to say gays kissing everywhere, because that sounds bad.
Okay. But, like, if we Pace have to cut the queer walking bit, we definitely have to cut gays kissing everywhere.
No, Pace and I just watched Dash and Lily. Like, we just put it on last night while I was grading. And it's, like, Netflix just put it on as, like, one of its Christmas series. And, like, the first episode, one of the main characters walks in on her brother and his boyfriend in their room. And that's just, like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is just, oh, haha, gay people exist. What a surprise.
I feel like it is happening a lot more, but I feel like it is kind of, like, all of a sudden.
Yeah, oh, it's, well, because now, like, yeah, it's, like, mandatory to, because, you know, gay people exist in the world.
What?
Like, you do, it's like people are realizing, oh, I have to, you know, I should probably put them in my television show, right, with a ton of real people. Like,
yeah, and it's something that's interesting because, you know, I think that because I live in a very small bubble, I sort of forget that most of the country that we live in, America, is very homophobic. Yeah, that's why it was so important and so shocking that first things, like the first primetime television kiss took place on this show in 2010, mm-hmm. which is really late, or, you know, all of the firsts that Glee had, which was, you know, most people's first run-in or interactions with.
Was the Glee after Modern Family?
I think, mostly it was during, though. Maybe it was a little bit before and a little bit during. But it also wasn't primetime, and originally it wasn't really considered, like, Glee was originally intended for adults, and so they got away with including a lot more things than Modern mm-hmm. Family did, because Modern Family was explicitly for family viewing.
Right.
It is a family sitcom mockumentary that premiered in September 2009. Set in Los Angeles, California, the series follows the lives of three successful yet dysfunctional families connected by patriarch Jay Pritchett. It was created by Christopher Lloyd and Stephen Levitan, who began writing about their own experiences raising their children, and it grew into more than a decade of content.
I have to include this because I love telling everyone this. Mm-hmm. The house that Cam and Mitchell are in for the series is across the street from my sister-in-law's house.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
Yeah, the outside that they used.
Every time a show took place in Los Angeles, it was very exciting for our childhoods because we lived in Los Angeles.
Oh, I know. When I worked on Hollywood Boulevard, there would be notices on the door of my building all the time, like, oh, hey, filming is going to take place mm-hmm. here, like, on these dates. It's fun. I do miss that.
It's so fun. And we lived in, like, we were there during the platinum age because we were there when, like, New Girl was filming, Modern Family was filming. We had some good shows down there.
I just realized, like, I don't have a show in my life right now that's, like, Modern Family or, like, New Girl. Like, you know.
A comfort show?
Well, like, not just that, but, like, a show that everyone is watching, that everyone loves, that's just generally sweet.
That's true. We're kind of also, like, in a sitcom lull right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's weird. I wonder what the next big one is going to be. I'm excited. When it aired, both audiences and critics alike adored what they were seeing, and though it petered out in its final seasons, it maintained high viewership until the very end, with the finale episode pulling in 7.37 million first-run viewers.
Wow.
I would like to say that number, when you compare it to, like, say, some of the numbers pulled in Friends, or even, like, early runnings of, like, you know, earlier seasons of, like, How I Met Your Mother and those kinds of shows, people started watching TV so much less from, like, in between 2008 to now, that mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to reconcile that with, you know, how many people are still watching. Mm-hmm. So it is, like, a crazy amount. And that was only for the first run of the, you know, premiere night of the finale. So people who were tuning in, they knew that this was the finale. They're sitting down to watch it live.
Right.
Crazy amount of people.
Well, I cannot remember the last time I watched something live.
Oh, yeah. No. Very, very, many years.
Yeah.
It has won many, many awards, some a few times. Over the course of the show, it won 22 Emmys.
That's a lot of Emmys.
It's way too many. It's for 5 seasons, each one the Emmy for...
It's an Emmy for each year of your life.
Oh, I'm 23.
It's an Emmy for each year of your life, except your first year, where you didn't do so well.
I was an underachiever. Its first 5 seasons each won the Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series, as well as the Emmy Award for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series 4 times, twice each for Eric Stonestreet, who plays Cameron Tucker, and Ty Burrell, who plays Phil Dunphy, and the Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series twice for Julie Bowen, who plays Claire Dunphy.
They were all really good in their roles.
They're amazing. And those are most of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
In 2011, it won the Golden Globe Award for Best Television Series, Musical, or Comedy. Modern Family revolves around 3 different types of families: nuclear, blended, and same-sex. The families are, respectively, Claire and Phil Dunphy and their 3 children, Haley, Alex, and Luke; Gloria and Jay Pritchett. Jay is the father of Claire and Mitchell. Gloria has a son named Manny, and they had their son Joe in their 5th year of marriage. Cameron and Mitchell Pritchett, their daughter Lily, and their son Rexford.
That name.
His middle name is Jason.
Oh, God.
Make Rexford the middle name. Today, we will be focusing on Claire and Phil. Who is Claire? Claire Melinda Dunphy is an...
Oh, my God, you got her middle name? Where did you get that from?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think she was named after a work colleague of Jay's. Which is funny because Mitchell's middle name, Vincent, is also a colleague of Jay's. It's his bestie.
That's funny.
Claire Melinda Dunphy is an organized, tenacious, and hardworking businesswoman. She has a degree in marketing, and before she left the workforce, she was an account manager at Seacrest Hotels. The first 5 seasons of the show, she's a stay-at-home mother and then works at her father's company, Pritchett's Closets. She stays at Pritchett's Closets for several years and inherits the role of CEO when her father retires, but then leaves for a senior VP position at her favorite organizational company, Organizem. Although there is some ambiguity as to whether she actually worked there or what happened to Pritchett's Closets after she was going to quit, or if she ever took Jay up on his offer to join him on his newest venture, a luxury dog bed company.
Oh yeah, that does not sound familiar at all, like...
It was really weird.
Huh.
The ending was just so open-ended with all of these different possibilities, because, of course, it's not like there's a true ending to this. Like, in Office, they were like, the documentary is ending. Or in Parks and Rec, it's Leslie became governor. Or, mm-hmm. you know, it's just very strange. There are some theories from fans that Claire took the job at Organizem, or, you know, decided to leave the workforce again entirely, and Jay used his extra time and energy, rather than create this luxury dog bed company, to mentor Claire's daughter, Haley, to take over the family business.
Well, I mean, also, like, she could leave, and they could just appoint someone else.
Yes.
To Pritchett's Closets, like, and still have a share in the company, you know what I mean?
Right. I think I just like this theory because it kind of saves Haley for me, because they really wasted her character for the last 2 seasons.
Oh, yeah. No, that would have been an amazing, like...
They kind of throw in that she's going to move to the French office of her... the Paris office of her lifestyle brand, but that lifestyle brand's legitimacy
right.
is put into question a lot, so I'm not sure what that had to do with anything. So
to be fair, though, they were like parodying Goop, and Goop is a multi-million-dollar brand that many people work at, so I don't think legitimacy is necessarily a problem.
That's very true. Who is Phil? Phil is a silly and compassionate real estate agent, originally from Key West, Florida. He is a talented musician, was a cheerleader through the collegiate level, and has attended trapeze school. He attended university in California, where he settled down, and although it's never explicitly stated what he majored in, he loved college. Phil is a devoted father, and one of his favorite things in the world is bonding with his children, often using a parenting method he coined, parenting. Parenting. Which is when you talk like a peer and act like a parent. He is a kind and open person who tries to make genuine connections with the people around him, even if they aren't really interested, like his father-in-law, Jay. He's constantly cheerful and helpful towards Jay, even through the curmudgeonliness, and jumps at any opportunity to spend time with him, do him a favor, and or impress him.
That was rough to watch.
It was hard to watch because he was just so sweet. That day that he spent, like, the entire day setting up his printer in his dusty attic and, like, spilled paint on himself, and then Jay didn't even give a shit. It made me so sad. How did they get together? Claire and Phil met after college, and they dated for about a year before she got pregnant with Haley. They got engaged a few months after. They got married when Claire was 4 months pregnant, and were told they eloped at a courthouse. We find out in the first season, Phil was still dating his ex-girlfriend Denise when he and Claire first started dating, even going as far as lying to Claire that he was going to Santa Fe to see his uncle while he was actually taking Denise on a trip. In season one, Denise comes over to their house and looks at old photos and meets Claire and Phil's family because she and Phil reconnected online and had been messaging.
Oh my god, I like forgot about that.
When Claire first finds out, she tells Phil that Denise is flirting with him, but he insists that it's completely platonic and shows Claire the messages to prove it. When Denise arrives, Claire tells Phil she thinks Denise is amazing and she was totally wrong about her. They all seem to get along swimmingly, but things start to unravel when we find out that Denise is trying to seduce Phil and convince him to leave Claire for her. Whoops. Phil tries to tell Claire what's going on, but she doesn't believe him and thinks he's trying to tease her because she and Denise get along so well. While they're looking at the photos, Claire and Denise realize that there had been an overlap between the two of them, and they both admonish him. But Denise was faking. And that's about all the resolution we get from that storyline.
Sometimes, real life, things just aren't resolved.
It was very interesting, and I, like, kept on skipping back and forward, thinking that I was, like, missing something in my scrubbing. But no, the episode just ends, and we never hear about it again.
What more can you say? He did a bad thing, and...
In season two, we get to see more into the playful side of their relationship. Although it seems to start somewhat rocky with events like Claire stealing Phil's notes for a speech at his work event because she was worried his jokes were terrible, it turns out positively with him being forced to improvise and receiving a standing ovation. And when she reveals that she had taken his cards, he thanked her for seeing that he was much funnier on his feet and that his prepared comments wouldn't have been such a hit. We see them race to Manny's birthday party and then back home and engage their kids in friendly competition with their parent and siblings. We also see the return of their roleplay alter egos, Clive and Juliana, who they first invented in season one for Valentine's Day. With Claire beginning the evening by pranking Phil into thinking that she'd forgotten about Valentine's Day, and then having Juliana lure him to a hotel bar. Unfortunately, in this season, we also see one of their first and biggest fights. And to make it worse, Phil spends the entire episode trying to figure out what the fight was about. In trying to piece together with Gloria what had made Claire so angry, Gloria tells him she's angry at even listening to how he treats Claire, and that if she was married to him, she would kill him. Phil realizes it wasn't one event that had caused her to blow up at him, but a series of missteps he had been totally oblivious of. He apologizes profusely to Claire and attempts to correct his previous mistakes, but she tells him what upsets her most is that she feels as though he doesn't listen to her and doesn't value her opinion. He tells her that he values her opinion above everyone else's and has been changed for the better by her influence on him the entire time they've been together, and they make up.
So for this one, did she, I don't remember this, but did she tell him what she was mad at him for? Like, with these missteps, did she say, hey, this made me angry?
No.
And he just didn't listen?
No. And she actually, for the most part, she didn't bring up all of those different things. It was the final straw was the only thing that she was thinking about because it kind of alluded to this whole larger issue of him not listening to her, which was He went to lunch with a colleague of his, Skip Woosnam, who he thinks of as kind of like a blockhead, like kind of a ditz, and he like raved to Claire all about how he had recommended a Cobb salad for lunch, and Phil was just like all over it and how she has to try it. And that's when she blows up, because she's been telling him for years that he should try a Cobb salad, and he was always saying like, it doesn't sound good, or it's not for me, or I don't like it.
Yeah. It's tough, because, like, on the one hand, people should know when they're doing something wrong, but on the other hand, they can't read your mind, so you do have to tell them along the way, hey, you didn't listen to me here, and that made me feel really hurt. And then it's on their plate. You know, it's the ball's in their court. What they do with it is what they do with it.
Yeah, and I think with the case of Phil and Claire, Claire does shoulder much of the emotional responsibility of their relationship. And for the most part, she is fine with that, and actually we see that she prefers it a lot of the time, and she likes fulfilling that role. But sometimes she is, you know, a little bit neurotic. She's a little bit of a stress puppy. We love her. We love that about her. But she just gets so overwhelmed that, like, it doesn't matter what she's angry about. She just knows that she's angry and something needs to be done right now, or she's going to kill everyone around her. And I think Phil, to his credit, is very good at recognizing that. And we see it a lot in that episode where he was like, okay, it was something that made her mad. She's not going to like it if I ask her. So he's like retracing his steps to work out what it had been.
Right. But that's I think that is something where that could have been solved and should have been solved. By her just saying, this is what they need now. He shouldn't have to figure it out, because that's time he's wasting not fixing what made her mad.
I will say that one of the things he should have known, because I distinctly remember that it was making plans with another ex-girlfriend, and considering how the last one went, he should have known that that was going to be something that frustrated her and triggered her frustration.
See, that's, I think that's one of the ones where the ball is in his court. But although, she ended up really liking the other ex-girlfriend, so it's like...
Not by the end of it. We just never got a resolution to that story, so we don't know.
Well, I thought by the end of it, they were both admonishing him.
Denise was faking, though.
But Claire didn't know that.
We don't know if she figured it out or she found out, because he'd been telling her that whole time that Denise had been coming on to him, and up until that point, she didn't believe him.
Oh, I assume she just didn't figure
it out. So because of...
And that Denise got upset and left.
Because of the fact that there was no resolution to that plot line, we don't really know. But Claire's not stupid. At the end of the season, we have two pretty rough Phil episodes in a row. In the penultimate episode, he tries to make Claire have a meltdown about Alex graduating middle school early so that he doesn't have to cancel a trip with his friends to comfort her. In the season finale, he runs into a college rival while shopping with Gloria and pretends that she is his wife to impress the rival. This later backfires when his rival tells him that he's surprised Phil didn't marry Claire, and that he'd always been so jealous of Phil because of how amazing Claire is.
That's really awkward.
It's even more awkward when you consider
the
fact...
Was Claire there?
No.
Okay, that's a little better.
No, it's not.
Then it's just like, he had Gloria there, and he didn't want to look like he was a loser all alone. You know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean, because if my husband was out with a woman who he is consistently making sexual references towards and making it very clear that he's sexually attracted to her, and that woman is my mother-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law who is 14 months younger than I am, and is something that continually gets pointed out.
No, I know. You'd have to not look at the rest. You'd have to not look at his pattern of interactions with Gloria, but if you just looked at this one
interaction. But we're looking at their relationship.
Well, we're not looking at Phil and Gloria's relationship.
Do you not think that Phil and Gloria's relationship affects his relationship with Claire?
No, but our listeners may not have watched this and know about Phil and Gloria's.
Well, that's why I'm adding the context.
But it wasn't added until I just brought it up.
Okay, the show's from 2009. either watch it TV. Or just listen to this podcast and enjoy.
Maybe they've been living off the grid in a cabin for the last 10 years.
Right. In season 3, we see Claire and Phil work together on a donations drive for their neighbors whose house had burned down, and Claire run for city council. Although she doesn't win, her family and Phil support her through the race and comfort her when she loses. When Phil gets a sports car instead of releasing his regular work car, Claire tries to be positive and not say anything about the limitations of such a small car. But Phil realizes himself soon enough that he'd made a mistake, and he and Claire swap cars for the day so he can carry his work materials. Claire spends the day doing her errands in the sports car and quickly falls in love with it, driving up to spend her day on the beach and loving every second of it before losing the car keys in the sand. Phil spends his day driving the family minivan and ends up loving the extra time he gets to spend with his kids. He drives up to get Claire in the sports car and apologizes for making an impulse decision and telling her that he's going to exchange the car. Claire tells him not to worry about it and that she loved feeling carefree again. They agree to travel more together and sit with each other on the sand before heading back home.
Okay, this makes me think of another thing that I was confused about, which is we see that Phil loves Nadad and he loves being with the kids and he's a natural, and I don't want to say like he wants to spend more time with the kids than Claire does, but like Claire's definitely very career oriented. So, like, why would they choose for her to be a stay-at-home mom when I feel like the natural choice would be for him to be a stay-at-home dad, given that they had about equal positions in the workforce?
They just did it naturally because of the assumed gender roles. Back in, you know, Haley was born in 97 or something, I don't think it was as common to just assume that the dad is going to be a stay-at-home dad. In season 4, Phil and Claire decide that it's time for Phil to get a vasectomy so they can ensure their 5-year plan won't be interrupted by an unexpected pregnancy. Phil gets cold feet while in the waiting room and decides he's not ready, while Claire gets cold feet after having an amazing day with her kids, and they both decide to put off the procedure for a few years.
That was so ridiculous. Did they really think they were going to have another child?
I don't know what that was. I think they were just like, they wanted to have the opportunity open just in case they changed their minds. But they never changed their minds. Spoiler alert.
And have another kid at 42, 43, 44, 45. Like, the next 5 years, that would be basically like mid to late 40s.
Not sure what that was about. Claire and Cameron team up to flip a house, and though Phil tries to stay only positive, it's revealed that he doesn't believe they'll be able to sell it after he accidentally texts their group chat his doubts while trying to tell just Mitchell.
Oh my god, that's the worst thing in the world. I hate it.
Eventually, they sell the house for a profit, but it was close, and in Phil's defense, he helped quite a bit. They attempt to revive their Valentine's Day characters this year, but their plans are cut short when Claire collapses and we find out that she has Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, which she inherited from her mother. Phil tries to stay calm, but Claire can tell he's very stressed about her health and that she's totally fine. Phil says he's more stressed that he knew that she was at risk for this, because her mother has it, and tells her that she can lean on him and be sick and vulnerable, and that he'll always be there to take care of her. They decide to call their evening early so that Phil can spend the rest of the night doting on Claire.
I totally don't remember this. What was it that she was diagnosed with?
Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
Did they describe that at all?
Like a heart murmur.
Interesting. And then it was never brought up again, I'm guessing.
Oh, never. Never, ever.
Yeah.
I don't even think Dee Dee dies during the series, spoiler alert, and I don't think that's what she died from.
Interesting.
In season 5, Claire returns to the workforce after accepting a job from her father at his closet company and immediately throws herself back into her work. Phil is entirely supportive of her, but they run into a few snags while adjusting, mainly Phil feeling as though he's being neglected and being bought off with gifts rather than getting any quality time or affection. Things come to a head when Phil buys an expensive, sexy suit to impress Claire, and she doesn't notice or compliment him all night. He later explains to her why he's upset, and she apologizes for being so busy with work, but it's been a while, and she wants to do everything she can to prove herself and her ability, and they make up again. I totally felt for Phil in this episode, though, because the suit was, like, super-duper tight, it was very expensive, it was very uncomfortable, and she literally had no reaction when he was, like, even when he was, like, kind of prompting, like, so what do you think of this suit? Mm-hmm. And she said that it's tight, And as someone who, like, hates being uncomfortable, when you dress up and, like, do your hair and put your makeup on and, like, there's no reaction or, you know, from anyone around you or the reaction that you were looking for, or you feel silly. I feel like feeling that silly and feeling that shame is just, like, even worse when you're all dressed up, because now you feel dumb.
Yeah.
And ugly. Even when you're fancy.
Oh, the food just got here. Okay, go get it. Yeah, and also, like, I don't know, I feel like it would be one thing if he just, like, showed up in the suit and... But, like, he specifically led her, like, hey, like, what do you think? Like, that's pretty obvious.
And he's, like, doing poses in the suit before that. Like it's, he was hinting not, pretty hard. Yeah,
she, like, that's something she should catch on to. So, that's really upsetting.
We also see Phil plan a surprise gift for Claire for their 20th anniversary, a song dedicated to her, written and performed by Phil at the school fair. Before he can go on, however, a colleague of his performs a solo and blows everyone away with his hidden vocal talent, and Phil is too embarrassed to follow with his performance. Claire says something is wrong and tells Phil she's feeling sick and he has to take her home early. And there, he's surprised with a private show by acrobats, and he's thrilled.
That's adorable.
And this is also a very special moment because Claire is horrible at giving gifts, and it's something that she's really self-conscious about. Because Phil is incredible at giving gifts. And throughout the years, we see, like, these really sweet, sentimental gifts from Phil. And Claire really genuinely tries to do the same, or at least give him a good gift. But even when she thinks that it's, like, absolutely perfect, like, she hired the bassist from the band who played their song, she got the song wrong, and so she got the band wrong, and so she invited the wrong musician. But, you know, these moments are really sweet. Phil can definitely see that she's, like, really trying, so he's making sure that she doesn't feel bad. But this time, his present kind of got ruined, and hers was so, so good and so on the point. It was kind of a perfect little flip-flop. Yeah. Towards the end of the season, we see Phil leaving the house empty while he's supposed to be waiting for a repairman to show up, but dashes out to grab a vintage record of the song that was playing while he lost his virginity, and misses the repairman. Worried that Claire would be so upset with him for not only missing the repairman, but for doing so to get a record that reminded him of a sexual experience he shared with another woman, he gets lost in more and more elaborate lies to hide him from being away from the house, before being forced by his stress to come clean about what happened, which Claire didn't care about.
That doesn't seem like something she would care about. She's very pragmatic, like...
No, yeah. And that whole episode, she's just so pissed off. She's been trying to get this repairman to show up for weeks, and he just keeps on leaving slips on the door, even though, like, she knows that she was there at a certain time, and so she's just really mad at this repairman. And so he finally tells her, and she's like, oh, so he did show up. Now I gotta reschedule! Like, it's very funny. Season 6 isn't very eventful for Phil and Claire's relationship, but we do see even more of them being playful and teaming up together when they start a rivalry with their next-door neighbors. Eventually, they all team up and become friends, but the beginning of their relationship is pretty full of hijinks.
And that's gonna show up in one of our future episodes, spoiler alert, which is, like, being playful with a partner.
Yes.
It's important.
Season 7 is also not terribly eventful, although we see Phil get super into raising ducklings and Claire feels somewhat neglected by how much attention he's paying to them rather than her. This is resolved, though, when Claire realizes that Phil has been so devoted to the ducks because their second child, Alex, had left for college and he was struggling with empty nesting.
That's a really... We should do an episode on that because, like, becoming an empty nester is a really big transition and it changes, like... your relationship with your spouse. Like, all of a sudden, it's just the two of you after years and years and years and years of having a full house. So,
that's so sad.
It's really tough.
We also see Claire thriving in her position at work, and Phil getting jealous of how she's balancing her work and home life, when he attempts several times in one day to take over Claire's duties at home, and finds himself stumped by her doing them first each time, he becomes suspicious and finds out that her schedule is physically impossible. This is also pretty funny, because he, like, he copied down her schedule and then tried to replicate it himself. He was like, she can't be in two places at once. It was very silly. It turns out she's been pretending to do it all while having her assistant, Ben, secretly taking care of her chores at home.
Oh my god.
Claire eventually realizes she's been asking too much of Ben and that he's been getting too involved in her home life, and so decides to lean on Phil to help with housework once again.
I need an assistant.
This episode is also very sweet. We get to see more of Phil as, like, how great he would have been that whole time as a stay-at-home dad, and how much he would have appreciated that time with his, like, little girls. Like,
yeah.
You know, he's trying to get Haley's dress dry cleaned, and he shows up with the dress, and she's like, this is the wrong dress because Mom already gave me the dress, because she always went to the dry cleaners. And he's like, but, okay. And then he baked lady fingers for some event that Alex is attending, and she's like, oh no, Mom already made cupcakes. And he's like, but my lady fingers. It was very sweet.
Poor thing.
In season 8, we see Phil's father get married, and the whole family turns up to the venue in full Western costumes at Phil's instruction, only to find they are the only ones in costume. Phil's kids and Claire tell Phil that he and his father can take jokes and skits too far, and that a surprise performance they find out about during the ceremony isn't a good idea. Phil talks to his dad, and they agree that they can get too whimsical at times and call off the performance. Meanwhile, Claire finds out that Phil's father's fiancée is massively whimsical herself, and they put the performance on themselves during the ceremony, surprising Phil and his dad. Mm. In season 9, Phil leaves his real estate firm and struggles to figure out what exactly he wants to do with his career, while Claire continues to thrive within Pritchett's closets. Phil decides to start his own real estate company, and Claire is in full support.
So, what prompted him leaving the real estate firm?
A few seasons ago, he was at this big real estate firm, and then two of the partners left and started their own firm and invited Phil. And then he agreed, and then over the course of those seasons, I guess, that company just started to fall apart.
Okay.
In season 10, Phil lands a job teaching about real estate at the local community college and falls in love with teaching and mentoring, and Claire and Phil prepare for a romantic vacation to Italy. Unfortunately, they decide to cancel their trip after they find out their daughter Haley is pregnant. They're both very present, supportive, and helpful to Haley during her pregnancy with her twins, despite being stressed out about it when they first find out. The final 11th season is mostly spent trying to tie up storylines with the kids and focused on Haley and the twins, but we do see Claire turn down Jay's offer to take over Pridget's closets, saying that she needs to strike out on her own, and she and Phil decide to start traveling in earnest.
Okay, that is so funny to me, because, like, I just don't understand how they can be starting their own businesses while also, like, actually traveling and, like, you know, trying to do that, which they've always wanted to do. I feel like they should have had them choose one or the other, because, honestly, them just, like, traveling across the country or across the world is an amazing storyline, like, end of the storyline for them. And I don't think they needed to make all this fuss with them, like, starting their own businesses.
Well, also because Phil, at some point in those last one or two seasons, he buys a magic store.
Oh, yeah.
That's, like, a huge, like, money suck that doesn't make any money and costs a lot of money. And we never really find out what happens to
them. Yeah. There's maybe a couple loose ends that they forgot to tie up.
This was a rough one, especially because their 11th season, I think they had planned for their 10th season to be their last one, and then they tacked on this one. And so you'd think that they would be able to tie up more, and it kind of just didn't do that.
Yeah. But, I don't know. I feel like throughout the course of the series, their relationship was always very strong. Like, they did have fights, like, everyone has fights, but, like, I feel like with Carla and actually, I honestly feel like their relationship is definitely less unstable than Carla and Turk's, to a certain extent. Like, you always knew that they were going to be with each other, and that it was going to be fine, and they were going to resolve things.
Yeah, and I think for all of those times where Phil is, like, tripping over himself about, like, a beautiful woman, or a Gloria, or making these inappropriate comments or committing sort of these relationship faux pas or, like, doing those kinds of things, I think the backbone behind all of those smaller actions is his absolute, complete, and utter devotion to Claire, and Claire being the, he thinks that she is the best thing that ever happened to him. And you can tell that that's true, even if he gets distracted by big boobies, you know? He's never not completely loving towards her. Although, I will say, he sometimes gaslights her a little bit.
Yeah.
Just, there was one season where he knocked her over with a cart into a pile of cans in the grocery store while he's flirting with, like, another lady. And he tells everyone that she's so clumsy that she's tripping over herself in the store and falling into a pile of cans as if it's this joke. And the only time that she actually snaps and is like, no, you actually did push me into that pile of cans. And she doesn't even mention the other woman at that point because they're in front of their children. But he's just like, oh, you're so crazy. And then she says, no, I am right about this. And he goes, right, Claire, because you're always right, no matter what. And it's like, Phil, you were being a fucking dog and you injured your wife. Don't be a dick.
That's what I'm actually, like, I feel like, well, they, I know that they put that aspect of his character in because it's like, oh, ha ha, this is like a funny thing that they can make fun of. But I feel like I'm disappointed in that choice because I feel like his character didn't need that and maybe didn't even deserve, like, didn't deserve that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange because it makes me really kind of understand how constantly on the edge Claire is. Because that's very frustrating, especially when you're as insecure as Claire is.
Yeah.
Especially about her looks. Like, even if she's securely confident in her motherhood, in her career path, in her decisions in life, she's very insecure about her looks.
Yeah.
And I think that that is one aspect that he kind of falls short on.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree.
But, great dad. Very dedicated husband.
Very, very good dad. Yeah.
Very committed.
Yeah. And good, like, a good family member, too, because he is always there for his other family members, for his father-in-law, and for Mitch and
his brother-in-laws.
Yeah.
Everything.
He's always there for them, too. Like, very family-oriented.
Yeah, and we see him reaching out to, like, extended family members, including extended family members of Claire's, like, her aunt, who everyone in the family hated, and he was still, like, very... We see that also with, I think, Phil, Gloria, and Cameron. The reason that they fit so well with the Pritchetts is that they're all very family-oriented, and so... When they met this giant family unit, they were very drawn to that.
I like also how those three, there were moments throughout the series where we saw them together acknowledging, like, oh, we're, you know, the people that came into the family. And I really
Own alliance.
Yeah, especially because they all came in at different times. Like, you know, Phil was first, and then... I don't know how long after. It must have been a while after that Cam came in. Because they were only together for 5 years when the series started.
Yes, it wasn't too long after because Phil, when he's talking to someone who's trying to get Jay's approval, he was like, oh, well, you know, oh, he's talking to Dylan. Where he was like, you know, I kind of got his daughter pregnant and then eloped with her, so I can understand why he feels some animosity towards me. And then Mitchell, not soon after that, not long after that, Mitchell brought home Cameron, so I was in the clear.
Okay.
Yeah,
Wait. If Cameron and Mitchell together 5 years, as I said, maybe they didn't start dating immediately, so maybe there was, like, I think at most of their... But the least, though, there must have been, like, an 8-year gap. Because Haley was already, like, 11, 12 when the series started. Oh, yeah, wait, Haley 5 years. 5-year gap.
Haley, yeah, he was born the same year I was, I think. Or 97.
So probably, yeah, maybe a 5-year gap. And also, Cam and Mitch could have met each other before they started dating, so it could have been more like 2-3 years.
They did know each other because Cameron was dating Mitchell's friend, Pepper.
Okay. Oh, okay. So that makes sense. Yeah, okay. So a 2-year gap, maybe.
And I do love their alliance of, like, the sort of, like, newcomer Pritchetts. And we do see this one episode that reveals that they all help each other hide things from the more neurotic branches of their family, which would be Jay, Mitchell, and Claire.
Yeah.
And they even have, like, code words for it. I think that's very fun.
Yes.
The family dynamics are honestly just great.
They are. They're really good. And they're really, real. Although I can never watch the ending because I cry so hard that I need to lay down.
No, yeah, that entire last season is, it's a mystery to me because I've only seen it one time.
Yeah.
And that is Modern Family.
It is.
In summary, opposites do not attract.
Well, you know what though? Because they're opposite in maybe some of their personality traits. But they're very aligned when it comes to their values and their goals for their family and their stance on child rearing, like having kids. So they do have a lot of similarities.
I think they're more similar than different, though. Maybe in the most noticeable differences, like she's very uptight and organized and he's very loosey-goosey.
No, that's, I agree. That's what I was trying to say, that, like, I do agree they're more similar than
they are. Because opposites do not attract.
Yeah. Yes.
But if someone has different hobbies than you, and you might be able to collect a few new hobbies.
Or just let them enjoy their hobbies by themselves, I say, as Pace is doing something.
One of his hobbies.
Should we give a sneak peek about what we're going to do?
I think you should give a sneak peek. I think you should give a hint.
Okay, let me see if I can think of a good hint. Let me check what we're doing. Okay, okay. Okay. So next time we're going to focus on a portion of not just marital relationships, because a lot of romantic relationships go through this, and it's like, it's a portion of the relationship that is probably the time, usually, where satisfaction is the absolute lowest. And we'll talk about how that usually doesn't stay that way, luckily.
I love that.
Yay! Okay,
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate and subscribe. And maybe write us a review on Apple Podcasts if you have a free minute after this, or a free 30 seconds. You could write anything on there. You could write poop.
Just write a series of hearts.
Yeah, you could put emojis. Try and send us a message with emojis, and I'll see if I can decode it.
Yeah. Text me.
Okay.
Okay, love you, bye.